Hello and welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Vecini. We are presented by The Athletic. Today on the show, Matthew Penny is in the building. Penny, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great. I'm assimilating back into society. First full weekend after the Final Four. We had the Masters. We had WrestleMania. We had UMass Hockey win a national championship. And unfortunately, just before we went on the air, Julian Edelman of the New England Patriots announced his retirement. So a real true roller coaster of sports emotions for me right now.
Are we going to get into is Julian Edelman a Hall of Famer? Because if he gets in before Hines Ward, I'm going to like throw things.
that's just the Pittsburgh in you. He should be ultimate competitor. I was lucky enough to see a Super Bowl or two with him, and yeah, we'll miss him running across the middle, but he's got to get healthy. I understand that. That stuff obviously comes first, but we'll miss him in New England.
I have an immense amount of respect for Warren Sharp just calling out how ridiculous it is that Julian Edelman gets Hall of Fame discussions and Hines Ward still has not made like the final ballot. And Hines Ward has 1,000 catches to Julian Edelman's 620, has 12,000 yards to Julian Edelman's 7,000. Has literally twice as many touchdowns, has the same amount of Super Bowl MVPs, and made 4 Pro Bowls. Like, where?
But what's his grit level though? Like, how gritty is he?
Gritty as shit. Did you ever watch those like crackback blocks?
Yeah, and Edelman was on the receiving end of many of those. But Bill Belichick had a really good statement, just saying he was this ultimate competitor. He did everything. He blocked. He rushed. He returned punts. He played defense, and epitomized what you want out of a Patriot.
Well, I got to live like you yesterday, Penny, because our friend brought her 2-year-old over to our house yesterday, and you know, I got to hang out with a 2-year-old for an hour, and at the end of it, I was like, I don't know how people do this for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Yeah. Welcome to the Thunderdome. Yeah, yesterday we were at Gillette Stadium yesterday. We did a drive-through truck show because my son's obsessed with trucks. So anything to pass a few hours, keep him happy, feed him snacks. Those are the dad hacks for 2-year-olds that I got so far. I'm not great at it, but I'm trying.
By the way, hysterical, because this small child was also obsessed with trucks. Part of the reason that they came over was because it was his birthday, his 2-year-old birthday, on the Sunday, and we had gotten him presents. So, being good aunts and uncles, we got him trucks and like dump trucks and things like that, like little toys. Yeah, it was like elite level child, just great kid. But
high major plus, yeah, trending up draft boards for kids.
But by the end of it, it's you're just like, oh man, this is a lot.
Yeah, you enjoyed the opportunity to go to sleep and watch a movie and not wake up at 6 a.m. I'm sure it's your little slice of serenity on the other side of the world.
I loved getting to spend the couple of hours that we spent with him, but I was like, oh boy, this is aggressive. Okay. So, in the vein of talking about the children that you get to see every day that I get to see occasionally, we're going to talk about all of our draft children today on this podcast. And the topic specifically that we wanted to dive into was, does winning matter for NBA draft prospects? And we have a couple of case studies that we think are pretty interesting when discussing this. But I guess that I will just pose this question to you from the jump. You know, Matt, how much to you as an evaluator does winning games matter versus kind of understanding the contextual situation of prospects and, you know, everything going on with the teams and the situations that they're engulfed within?
Well, having to understand the nuance of that, we'll never know the full dynamics and chemistry of a locker room or a school situation. Winning definitely matters to me. It's definitely something that I look for guys to even power through adversity that they come across during the year. It's more if it's a complete losing situation and you can kind of tell with body language that they're not doing their best to kind of rise above or separate themselves from it. So I look at, obviously, winning positively. It's not the be-all, end-all, but as we've kind of discussed, too, it definitely varies by franchise, too. There's teams, and you can see the drafting patterns. They'll take 4-year seniors. They'll take consensus APL Americans. They'll take guys from winning rosters over maybe a more skilled, talented player that was on a losing team. So it depends really who you ask. For me personally, it's definitely a weighted metric, but it's not the whole story.
Yeah, I do think winning matters. I agree with you. But I also do care about the context of the situation. Like, I need to know if you're losing, like, say, Anthony Edwards last year, right, with Georgia. Georgia was not a very good team. Georgia was also specifically not a very good team for Anthony Edwards last year. They shot, I'm pulling up the number now, if I remember correctly, they shot something like 29% around Anthony Edwards from three last year. They took some threes, but in general, like, just didn't really have any floor spacing around him outside of Rayshon Hammonds, who could, like, you know, pick and pop and occasionally knock down a shot. But I wouldn't say Rayshon Hammonds, the teams were necessarily concerned about him stepping away from three. Like, you look back, Donnell Gresham, 30%, Tamani Kamara, who I think is really good, 17% from three, Tyree Crump, 33%, Sevier Wheeler, 30%, Ty Fagan, 26%, Jordan Harris, 29%. Like, these guys just don't shoot well from three, and that caused a lot of problems for Georgia's offense. And then on top of it, also, there were issues defensively. Now, the offensive side, I kind of got past it because you can just see Anthony Edwards' incredible offensive abilities. Now, I will say, like, part of the reason that I had Anthony Edwards at number three on my board last year was I do worry about how his game is going to translate to winning basketball, because he was a significant part of why Georgia's defense was so bad last year. He just didn't give the requisite effort necessary. They had the worst defense in the SEC, and it just, like, there was no togetherness. There was no cohesion. It just didn't work in any way, shape, or form. But it did lead to me just being like, okay, I need to evaluate how does this work in a winning situation? Because ultimately, I don't know if you knew this, Matt Penny, but the goal in the NBA is to win games. Just full stop.
Okay. Well, lofty goal. But if we look at, everyone didn't get out of jail free card last year, but with the virus and everything spreading and the cancellation of the tournament, technically teams did not make the tournament, but the other guys just sort of in that lottery-ish range who weren't on great teams. Even Tyrese Halliburton, that team at Iowa State wasn't great, but everyone's raved about him and what he's able to do that year and what he's able to do for the Kings right now. Aaron Naismith, he was hurt, but Vanderbilt wasn't great. Cole Anthony, North Carolina, they weren't great. Even Washington, Isaiah Stewart, they weren't great. So you have to be able to balance it somehow and not just look at the record and say, that's going to place this guy 10th. I mean, ability will still find its way to separate itself. But then you also have guys who are playing more kind of like rotationalist minutes on winning teams and not able to showcase their whole skill set. It's more of the bigger red flag to me when a lottery picks team doesn't make the tournament. Because I'm just a believer that You can be around kind of a dumpster fire type situation, but if you're really going to be that good and a difference maker on an NBA team to win games, like you said, you hope you find a way to carry your team to at least the first weekend of the NCAA tournament.
See, like, I don't even know that, like, specific, that I care as much about the specific qualifiers of, like, did this guy's team qualify for the tournament? I think that, like, it's more specific for that than me. Like, I care, okay, is this guy's team winning? Great. Is he adding to the reason that they're winning? Yes. Great. Is this guy's team losing? Oh no, that sucks. Is this guy's play adding to the reason why they're losing? Or are they losing in spite of him, you know, trying to put up Herculean efforts around them, right? So, like, I'm trying to think of a 2020 NBA draft example, just kind of off the top of my head. Like, Edwards, I think, was, you know, a good example of kind of the one side of the spectrum that I was talking about. Maybe it is like Isaiah Stewart. Like, Isaiah Stewart, that team was not very good. And honestly, like, we could probably do this around, like, both Isaiah and Jaden McDaniels, right?
Sure, yeah, pair them together.
Isaiah Stewart and Washington was not very good last year. For the most part, Isaiah Stewart had nothing to do with why they were bad. Like, every night, night in, night out, Isaiah Stewart put up 17-9 and like played reasonable in terms of rim protection and did exactly what we hoped he would do. At the end of the day, like that's what happened with Isaiah Stewart. Jaden McDaniels, on the other hand, and this is an example of why this like isn't perfect, right? Because Jaden has looked fantastic so far.
Lately, especially.
Early NBA career, yeah. But Jaden McDaniels did not necessarily help Washington in any way, shape, or form. He was okay on defense, but was inconsistent in terms of his effort level there. Was inconsistent in terms of shot selection. It got to the point where like they benched him midway through the Pac-12 season, and like we can talk about if that was a prudent decision or not, right? But at the end of the day, they decided that we are better when Jaden McDaniels plays, you know, somewhat fewer minutes, not always like way fewer minutes, because he'd still get up to 35 33 minutes 32 minutes. But there was a stretch there where he was getting like 29 20 28 22 16, because they frankly felt like he was not really contributing to them solving the problems of winning. So I think that I'm more willing to forgive someone like Isaiah Stewart in regard to like the winning aspect when it's very clear that that player is not at fault in terms of why they're not winning.
Especially, I'd say, from the big position, too. Maybe I'm just more hypercritical of guards and wings, especially in the NCAA, because they create so much offense and have the ball in their hands so much. As a big, you can be a little bit limited into your touches or what the flow of the offense looks like. And maybe it's more so you take a deeper look when you had two first-round picks or let's say first-round prospects in Isaiah Stewart and in Jaden McDaniel, and even last year in Arizona when they had Josh Green, Nico Mannion, Zeke Nagy. When you don't reach the kind of level of success which was maybe projected in the preseason or the expectation level, when you have that caliber of prospect and those guys were all kind of earmarked as one and done early, you have to look into behind the layers of why it didn't work. And sometimes it can be that. It can be just the pieces didn't match behind the scenes, but other times maybe it is a show of lack of leadership at times. It could be the sets weren't necessarily working for the right personnel. There's a variety of things of where it can go wrong. Maybe I'm kind of like changing my view a little bit on the fly. It's more of a concern if a team to me is like below 500 as opposed to, all right, they're on the bubble and didn't make the tournament.
Yeah, and like
I know it's not changing your view, but if a team is like 10-20, I have to look closer at why was that team 10-20, and if this player is a lottery pick, how come it didn't impact it more that they could at least get to 16-14?
But like the other example with this is at the top of the draft last year was LaMelo Ball, right? Illawarra was not a very good team in the NBL last year. They were actually pretty bad even when LaMelo was there. They were, frankly, even a little bit better when LaMelo was gone. Then you look at this year, like, LaMelo is one of, I don't know, two rookies this year, tops? And frankly, really the only true difference maker who has been able to contribute, like, positively to a winning situation. Like, Charlotte was a 500 team when he was there, and they... LaMelo Ball was frankly the second best and at times the best guy on the Charlotte Hornets this year. So it's not the be all end all, but like I do think winning matters. I think that like showcasing that you're willing to downshift into a smaller role is important. Like we're going to talk about like Josh Christopher and Cam Thomas at some point today. Like I worry about how scalable their games are to a smaller role, and thus, like, if they're in a bigger role, they're not quite good enough to be, you know, the best players on good teams, right? So, yes. Scalability in terms of skill set matters, like, just willingness to downshift, just like willingness to be a team guy matters. And, like, Frank, like, here's the deal. There, like, I was seeing some conversation about RJ Barrett yesterday, right? Because RJ Barrett has figured things out. And RJ Barrett is about as strong, maybe not like the strongest, but a very, very high level number three overall pick right now. Because RJ Barrett is like rolling toward being something like, I don't know, like a top, he's on the trajectory of becoming like a top 30-ish player in the league, Right. And you think about like the player pool.
But yeah, he could go that way. Yeah.
Yeah. You think about like the player pool that is in the NBA. Let's say that in any given year, you would expect, like, in a perfect world, that the last 10 drafts is the player pool. Now, like, we'll have guys like Chris Paul who are older and LeBron James who's in his 17th year. But for the most part, I would venture that 94% or something like that, 92% of the player pool is probably from the last 10 drafts, right?
Yes.
So if you get, in a perfect world, this obviously does not play itself out in practicality, but in a perfect world, you would expect the top 30 players in the league to be top three picks, right? Because, and look, that doesn't account for the strength of certain drafts versus the other drafts, right? But if you end up with a top 30 player in the league at some point from a number three overall pick, you should be very, very happy with that production. And I think that it kind of just goes to show how often we kind of, I don't want to say like overrate the value of these picks, because these picks are incredibly important due to the cost control and due to the like amount of time that a player is tied to a specific team in the league. Like if you take a top three guy and he works out, you essentially get him for either 8 or 9 years as a team. And if you can't figure out to win in 8 or 9 years in the NBA, that's on you as a team.
right. But it's so, some of it, too, when you look at RJ and we talk about drafts and everyone's kind of doing their top five, their big boards, people are updating their stuff. Never do we go back a year later and say, nailed it. Every 10, or an order, who's the best guy,
right?
1 through 10. RJ Barrett was third in that draft. I don't know who you even argue was like the pick you'd take over him there when you kind of dive in. I mean, he's really settled into being probably the third best player there. I mean, Tyler Hero has clearly had his moments. I mean, PJ Washington's been good. Rui Hachimura's been okay. Cam Reddish has shown flashes. People really like Brandon Clark. He's a little
when
bit
I did mine, I had DeAndre Hunter a little bit higher. DeAndre got hurt, obviously, this year. But early in his, you know, first or second year here in Atlanta, he was showing flashes of being like, oh shit, like big 6'8" wing playmaker, you know, defender, all that stuff.
Yeah. And I would have had, to go back to RJ, I would have had concerns if with that RJ and Zion Williamson team, if they weren't good. Like with those guys, picks 1 and 3, right, you have to be good. I gave sort of a half hand wave that we've made famous here to LaMelo Ball because he did only play 12 games in Australia. Right. He was on the whatever Big Baller Association was in America before that. He was at Spire Academy. So I even argue with him, and this is, again, proving myself wrong, he wasn't necessarily in winning situations all the time either, and he's adapted more, at least on surface level, and I could be way off here, and some of the organization could pipe up, but it seems he's fit in and done everything he's supposed to do as a professional as well, and is committed to being part of that winning culture and not necessarily satisfied with his lofty stats. I think there was one game where one of his teammates slapped him in the head because he tried to get like a phantom rebound late to pad his own numbers, but that also happened with a lot of rookies too.
Yeah, and in like, look, we don't need to like relitigate the like LaMelo case, but like you talk to people around Australia, and everyone around Australia that I talked to was like, no, he seems like a pretty good kid and is in the gym, and there's no reason to be worried about any of this. Like it was hard for some teams to get by that. And like we were talking about something earlier, like that didn't stop teams from having LaMelo Ball like as a guy that they weren't particularly interested in having either. Like that stuff happens too. Like there are certain situations where teams are just not interested in taking players. Not every team's board is going to have every player on it because certain teams just like don't like certain players. And you know, like for me, like I'm not a big Cam Thomas guy. Like we've talked about on this podcast multiple times. I will have Cam Thomas demonstrably lower on my board than where he is likely to be selected during the draft. But at the end of the day too, like that's kind of the way the teams operate, you know?
Sure. And I've had similar conversations about similar prospects, and I was on the Johnny Juzang hot seat last week, and I caught some flack for taking Christopher over Cam Thomas and for him, but that's just sort of how I value shooting with size over other things. And you talk to NBA teams and their boards are very different from mock drafts. And obviously we don't have the access to what they actually look like, but when you gather enough intel from talking to different sources, their boards aren't going to look like yours that you post on The Athletic or other websites. Yep. They're very dependent on what the specific thing, tongue twister, they're looking for, whether that's shooting or toughness or ability to play within the flow of the offense. They're not necessarily looking for all superstars of where they may pick. There could be a top three guy, and you mentioned LaMelo. Some people probably didn't have him as high because of there was concerns and they've kind of been quelled about character stuff. Some people may have not liked Anthony Edwards. Some people may have thought, all right, James Wiseman's a five, he's a big, he's not going to fit what we're doing. That's not a slight against those guys, but it has to be very specific to the culture of an organization, the fabric of what they're trying to produce on the court.
Yeah, totally. So it is what it is, and I think that most people would be surprised about, like, you know, how many conversations we have per year where teams will just tell us, like, yeah, you know, like, seems like a good prospect, but we're not real interested. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. No, he'll be in the 20s, but not for us. We have a 54. It's like, whoa, what's the disconnect there between a guaranteed deal and maybe you're fighting for a two-way?
Yeah, like, the one that I remember most vividly is Lu Dort. Like, I had Lu Dort as a late first-round pick. I talked to a couple teams that had him, like, in the same range I did. Then I talked to teams that were like, nah, he's, like, 60 for us. Like, we just don't think he's ever going to shoot it. And that's fine. Like, I think that it was a different take than I have. I don't even think it was a wrong take, necessarily.
Yeah. It's a good victory lap for you, though, too, because how good Lu Dort has been, especially defensively.
Well, I'm trying to think of in that vein, like, in making
fun of. It's a good one, though, because that's a perfect example of people also probably world famous revisionist history. We had him 25th, but, you know, we drafted 22nd. He wasn't there, and then he's panned out, and people are saying how much they love him.
Well, and, like, here, we'll make fun of me for a second here. Like, I had Chandler Hutchison at, like, 16 or so on my board, and I was like, yeah, like, I really like the athleticism. I think he's going to shoot it. I love the way he handles it and drives to the rim. Problem is, the jump shot just never came, like, for Chandler. Right. And I talked to a lot of teams that were like, yeah, we just don't buy the jumper. Like, we think it's very mechanical. We think that it just doesn't really work. And they were proven right. And I think that Chandler is a good example of someone that I've tried to learn from in a lot of different ways. But, yeah, nonetheless, like, there were teams that had Chandler around where I did, and I think the Bulls are certainly one of them.
Yeah, I think so. But we all miss, right? We all miss.
And like, we all miss,
not,
right?
We're not perfect. We're all kind of learning as we go. Everything looks good on paper, and it's the same with pulling it back into my world of high school kids and rankings. And development matters, and what guys keep working on their game and developing their skill set and what their weaknesses are. But if you pull up the five ranking sites, everyone's pretty close. There's like a standard deviation of maybe five or six spots. It's the same with most mock draft boards. Nobody does anything outrageous and says Zion Williamson should be ninth, or, you know what, I really like Cade Cunningham, he should be fourth. No one's taking that really big leap of faith, and it's not a shot or a commentary on anyone. It's just we all kind of settle into the same opinions, and behind closed doors, NBA teams don't always do that. And this draft,
do you think that's, by the way, like, do you think that's weird with high school kids? Like, I always have very different takes when it comes to high school kids than what I think the consensuses are. And, like, you don't even really release, like, a ranking board. So, like, it's...
No, I don't.
Yeah, it's like a little
bit... It's different because there's different, I'd say, like, weighable things that each site would do. Some say a little bit more of pro potential. Some say a little bit right now. Some are a combo. So it's difficult to just exactly pinpoint what the differences are. There's some guys I like more, some guys I like less. But I don't think it's necessarily astronomical. It's a very tough thing to do and to project. And that's why a lot of NBA teams are happy that you have to do the one and done and not come out of high school, because we look at guys who are projected the top 10, 20, sometimes it doesn't pan out and you're surprised by it. But when it's a different level of basketball and not a national high school level, just the competition is different, how you adjust and some of your skills may not translate. But it's just to go back to the current draft right now, as much as I like the top five, you and I can both agree right now, there's gotta be somebody that's as good as those that we say we missed them. And I don't know who it is.
Yeah.
I do it the same year in high school. We missed them. Everyone is so hell-bent on this top five, and even it's getting, I don't want to say trendy, but popular for Davion Mitchell to be six. There's going to be somebody outside that group, and it doesn't keep me up at night, but I think about who's that guy we're missing right now.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely going to happen. It's funny because you to go back to the recruiting thing, I understand why it ends up being rounded into some sort of consensus, because I think it's really hard to make recruiting rankings because every single team in college, not every single team, but like there is such a wide swath of different systems and schemes that teams run in college that certain players like just will not work in certain schemes.
Absolutely. I had the conversation today with a college coach who were talking about another player in his conference who hasn't quite lived up to expectations. And he said, I don't know if he knew what they were going to run. And the set isn't really as open, not really as kind of NBA concept. And sometimes guys need a different change of location, I guess, in order to really show what they're able to do. And that's important in choosing your college, because that's your last showcase opportunity before you're thrown into the fire of the NBA, where they don't have time for you not to like a scheme that a coach may run.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely right. So let's do a quick case study in terms of what we're talking about, right? So Iodesumu this year, his team in Illinois was one of the four best teams in the country, let's say. I know they didn't make the Final Four, but like Illinois goes 24-7, has crazy number of important wins, beat Michigan, beat Iowa twice, beat Ohio State a couple times, if I remember correctly. You know, played pretty competitively with Baylor early in the season. In general, a very, very high level team. Arizona State, on the other hand, was a bad basketball team this year. They went 11-14. Josh Christopher played 15 games. Marcus Bagley played 12 games. Even when they did play together, this team was still kind of a mess, if we're going to be honest. Like, Marcus Bagley did not play in the game against UTEP, but Arizona State lost by 13 to UTEP. Do you remember that?
Unfortunately, I do not. I think by that point in the season, I had moved on to other Pac-12 teams.
Yeah, like they lost to Oregon State, like
Oregon State's good.
Christopher and Bagley, but this was still at the point where Oregon State was, let's say, figuring some things out, given that they were 5-5 at that point and had lost to Washington State, Wyoming, Portland, Stanford, and Arizona, and still had not beaten a top 100 team in the country. What do we do when it comes to the idea of winning when it comes to prospects like this? Because Iodesumu is a guy, talks to people around NBA teams, talks to people around Illinois, elite level kid, elite level worker, high level character, everything like that. Every trait that you associate with a kid who's going to keep getting better and who is going to keep being a part of potential winning teams. On the other hand, like Josh Christopher and Marcus Bagley, you don't hear, I don't want to say that like they have like negative like character concerns. I don't think that they have character concerns per se, but it's not as effusive a praise as you get when you talk to people about Iodesumu. Would you agree with that?
I would, yes.
Yeah. So how do we navigate these players? Because frankly, like all three of them probably going to be taken somewhere like 20 to 45, let's say.
Yeah, that's the range. And to start with Io, he sort of did everything scouts asked for him to do when he came back to school. 20 points per game, 6 rebounds, 5 assists. His three-point percentage was up 10 points to 39%. It was his lowest number of attempts at 82 in three seasons. He had 2 triple-doubles. The advanced metrics are fine. The not eye-popping, I'd say, one way or another. I don't really buy the shooting right now. With the eye test, especially on the release, he tends to turn his body a little bit. His legs can go opposite directions. When he does shoot straight up and down, even off the dribble, he looks a lot better and hits a higher clip. Can still be a little bit loose. And the most negative feedback I've received is the 3.3 turnovers a game does scare scouts, because it's not the tightest handle. And My concern is always how he is when it becomes the half-court game. He's really good in transition versus Loyola in the NCAA tournament, who are incredible defensively. He had 9 points on 4 of 10 shooting and 6 turnovers. His biggest scoring outputs are mostly against teams that finished in the lower tier of the Big Ten. So the winning part, as important as it is, I think we have to wear our evaluation goggles a little bit and more question, is he able to play his style in the half court in the NBA going forward? And it's not always going to be a transition game. That's my hold up with Io. I'm not taking away any of the success they had, and he was tremendous in the Big Ten tournament. Came back, fought through. We talked about his character. He breaks his nose. He plays on. But there are still things that you kind of have to dig deeper.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's right. And I think the same can be said for Christopher. I mean, where are you at with just trying to navigate Josh Christopher and his very strange season where he has the breakout game against Villanova?
Yeah.
And then, you know, frankly, like by the end of the year, it seemed like Bobby Hurley was not pretty happy with the fact that he missed their last, I think it was 10 games.
Yeah, I think they were 5-9 or something around there. He averaged 14 a game. He did have that leg injury all year. Can be a volume, low percentage shot guy in the shots that he actually takes. I like his wiggle with the ball. Definitely needs to be reeled in some from some of the freewheeling decision making. I think that's why his numbers are a little bit lower, because he can take some wild shots when he can just take normal ones and he'll be fine. Per synergy, he was in the 91st percentile in transition scoring, but the jumper metrics are below average in the 28th percentile. He's really good, kind of like Io, when the game is a track meet. The 21 assists to 26 turnovers, not looking great from a passing standpoint. As a stock perspective, it's tough because it's an incomplete snapshot, but I keep getting drawn back to high school a little bit into how good of an isolation scorer he was. And I know we just like discredited what you do in high school before you get to college, but I think that's the reason I'm still a little bit higher on him than maybe the general consensus is. Still in like the 20-ish late first range. I'm not doing anything crazy and saying he's 12th. But I guess the scoring I'm still hung up on a little bit. Whereas I think for you, with Cam Thomas, you're the opposite direction. You're a little bit lower on him.
Well, yeah. And the reason I kind of want to keep it to Christopher and Dosunmu is because it's two very stark examples of winning mattering versus like not mattering for some people.
Yeah, absolutely. Right?
With Christopher, like, did you feel like when you watched Arizona State this year, which, like, you know, frankly, was not a fun watch for large swaths of the season, but did you feel like he was contributing to Arizona turning it around, or did you feel like he was contributing to the problems? Because, like, I often thought that, like, his desire to just, like, take over possessions and freewheel and take these terrible-looking shots and frankly, like, take shots that, you know, led to him shooting 30% from three because they were contested and, like, bad decisions. Like, I didn't think that helped Arizona State. You know what I mean?
No, I didn't. And it was once the season wore on and he came back from injury, it was a different player than that Villanova game where everyone was writing articles about how it was the best prospect game of the early season, and he really stood out with his scoring, and Bagley was the same way, and Remy Martin wasn't bad too, and it looked like it was going to be the season for Arizona State. They had all the pieces in play, but with injuries and other issues that they dealt with, it never really, the train never really got going. And I do take pause with them being below 500 and him not even taking better shots, I'd say, toward the end of the season. It was just more of the same as it wore on. And going back now and watching tape, you have to investigate further of how do we really get here.
Right. Yeah, I mean, like, look, I would take Io ahead of Josh Christopher. And part of it is that I think that the mentality that Io has shown makes me feel a bit more confident that his game is going to lead to winning basketball games. And, like, by the way, look, Illinois in Io's freshman year, which same year that Josh Christopher just played at Arizona State, Illinois was terrible in Io's freshman year. Like, they went 7-13 in conference, 12-21 overall. He had many of the same kind of warts that Josh Christopher did. So how much of it is unfair based on like young kid playing and adjusting to college basketball? I don't know, but I also don't really think I want to pay for those couple of developmental years with someone like Josh Christopher late in the first round if I don't think the upside is like wildly unbelievably high.
Right. And we can get into an age debate on a different pod about how much we do value what you're able to do and waiting on 2 or 3 years of development. It's a great point about how Io probably had some similar type of weaknesses his freshman year with Josh Christopher. But when you're here and you're in college basketball, you don't really have time to wait when you're going to be in the NBA. This is how you're judged on. You're not going to be judged on, well, if he went back to school for two more years, maybe he's first team all conference in the Pac-12 and he declared for the draft, he signed with an agent. You're all the same now in the sense of we're looking at you under the same lens and are you going to impact winning? Because that's ultimately what we're trying to do in the NBA.
Yep. And how long is it going to take you to get to the point where you play winning basketball as well? Like that's a real question. Okay, let's take a quick commercial break and we'll be right back with something I've just kind of wanted to ask Penny for a little while now. All right, and we're back. The question I've been wanting to ask you, Penny, and it kind of dovetails nicely with what we were just talking about with Arizona State, is who is the player that you're struggling with most right now on your board? Because my pick for that is Marcus Bagley.
Okay, keep on the Sun Devils, yep.
Yeah, I frankly don't know what to do with him. Because if you just look at the way the trajectory of this all has played out with Bagley, he was a guy that was seen as like a likely 2-year guy, potentially even like 4-year guy early in his high school career. Because I mean, like, look, I don't mean to be like disrespectful or anything, but like people just kind of thought of him as Marvin's brother and like not as a real one and done prospect in his own right. Like he was seen as like a good 4-star prospect. When he was a freshman and sophomore in high school. Is that fair?
Absolutely fair.
So over the course of Marcus's time in high school, he continued to get better and then really started to emerge late in his career, like during his senior season, as someone that like, okay, this really might be a one and done kind of deal. You know what I mean?
Yes, very late.
The problem with that is that then the pandemic hit. So we didn't really get a chance to go and like see Marcus Bagley, see what he looks like in these all-star events, see what he looks like in different settings. Because I think he would have gotten invited to something like a Jordan Brand Classic, something in that range. And then we would have gotten to see him in that event. We would have gotten to see him in some of these other all-star events. We would have gotten more of a chance to see him like as a high school player and everything. So the pandemic ended up throwing everything for a loop, right? And then on top of it, this year he plays 12 games for Arizona State. And the flashes, especially early in the season in those 12 games, are really good. He has 10 points against Villanova and, you know, shot 3 of 8 from three and looked good against Rhode Island and had like the enormous game against Houston Baptist and then had a really good game against Oregon State, had a good game against USC, if I remember correctly, where he had like 11 points and 13 rebounds and did some of the little stuff that people have wanted him to do. UCLA, he had 11 points and 11 rebounds in that game. So the problem that we keep running into with Marcus Bagley is that I think we don't know, like, even based on the tape, and look, I've probably watched 4 Arizona State games on tape and then like have gone back and like tried to find what I could from high school stuff, like, you know, with the trajectory of not a one and done, like up to, hey, this guy might be a one and done, up to like the early season where it became, hey, he really might be like a guy that goes in the first round this season. I think like it feels like I'm going to have to go through and watch literally every Arizona State game to see every single possible minute that Marcus Bagley played this year. Because and even then, I don't know if we're going to have enough tape to really know what his level is as a prospect, because it's happened so rapidly, but we don't have enough of a sample. Like, you could, honestly, you could tell me that Marcus Bagley has a better career than Franz Wagner, and I would 100% believe that. Like, that
I was going to say, I'd 100% say maybe.
Well, but like, you could also tell me that Marcus Bagley should go back to Arizona State because he's nowhere near ready to play in the NBA. And if he goes through this draft process, he goes like 55. And I would 100% believe that. Like, I do not know what to do with Marcus Bagley right now. Is there a guy that, like, A, what do you think of Bagley? And B, like, is there a guy that you're struggling through kind of like that right now, like I am with Bagley?
There's a lot of guys I'm struggling with, and I've said ad nauseum about how after five, I don't know what to do. I felt personally I had a much better handle of last year's draft mid-first down. There's so many guys like Bagley, to me, I don't know where to put them, because you watch those first three or four games of the year, even when the three wasn't falling, the jumper mechanics looked very clean, the ball came off his hands, he was making a few plays off the dribble, not crazy, but when the shot wasn't falling, he was attacking a little bit more, he was rebounding really well, had some injuries, and from like the tail end of January until the last game of the year, when he was off and on playing, he wasn't great. I don't think he scored his last game, so I don't know where to put him either, and then it gets compounded by they're losing. So they needed him to be good, and he wasn't. If you told me that somehow he ends up 15, I'd say that's ambitious. I'd say probably the same if he ended up at 50. Like, his range is, to me, is so wide, because if you do have time to invest in a 6'8 guy who could probably shoot, who's pretty athletic, who has some tools that you're willing to be patient as he puts together, I get taking a swing, but there, man, it becomes no man's land after like 20-ish. So if I would guess, I don't remember your last big board, I would guess you have him late first, but when he creeps into that early second, that's not going to blow me away either.
Yeah, I had him early second. I kind of, like, the more I think about the way that the game works, like, I'm a little bit more intrigued by late first, but, like, I genuinely think I'm going to have to, like, I'm nowhere near done evaluating him. Like, I think I'm going to have to go back and watch every Arizona State game this year. So, like,
The good thing is he played in, like, 11 of them, so you don't have to, right. You don't have to watch 30 games.
Right, absolutely. Like, last year I had to watch, like, 25 Georgia games, and holy shit, do you start to, like, lose confidence.
Yeah. In rotational defense, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know what, though? If it did prove anything to you, it's that with the metrics of an NBA court, Anthony Edwards is going to be able to have some highlight-level plays, which he's done.
Right.
Matched with actually highlight level post game interviews too, which we'll give him credit for.
Oh my
God. He's having fun. I enjoy it. My personal guy, he just declared officially for the draft today, is Aaron Henry from Michigan State.
In that vein, by the way, I should say, like, Marcus Bagley is not officially declared. Like, he is maintaining his eligibility.
Right. Right. That's right. He didn't sign with the agent. Not all the way in. Aaron Henry is all the way in.
Yep.
Under 30% from three, 29.6. I know it's close as a three-point shooter. 2.9 turnovers per game. He rebounds it well with almost six a clip. Defensively, he's a strong shot blocker from the wing. 1.3 blocks a game, 1.3 steals. I like his size at 6'6", 210. I would say he trended in the right direction the second half of the year. He's strong, he's athletic, he slashes, but he is a below-average catch-and-shoot guy. He's not super fluid when the ball swings to him and he has to have his feet planted. He seems much more comfortable when he can dance with a few dribbles and then pull up. All Big Ten defensive team. We don't have to get into postseason awards, but he was benched a little bit during the season. Most of the feedback I've gotten is late first at the highest, but another guy who I would probably feel more comfortable in the second round, and seems there's some NBA teams that echo that same thought.
Yeah, when I talk to teams, it's definitely more early second than late first. I would say more like 35 to 45 is what I get. I will be a little bit higher on Henry because I really think that he's going to be able to shoot directly off the catch. And that's the swing skill. Like, teams that think he's going to struggle to shoot see him more like in the 40s. Teams that think he's not going to struggle to shoot, as you put him into a smaller role and just say, hey, Aaron, catch and shoot. If they close out hard, take two hard dribbles and hit a kickout pass. Those teams tend to think that that, along with his defense, is a very translatable skill, and that they think he's more of a like late first round guy. For me, that's where I'm at. I think he's a late first. I don't know what, you know, he could go anywhere from 22 to 45, and I think I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah.
Right. He was actually better, I'd say, from an offensive confidence standpoint in that playing game, which they lost to UCLA, and UCLA goes on this magical run. But there's a few moves where he like crossed over, he stepped back, he released it a little bit quicker. It seemed like he believed in the shots going in when earlier in the tape in the season, there was some hesitancy on his dip, on his release, kind of like willing it in. He's got to get more toward 35% from three. You can't be a 29% three-point shooter from the college three and hope that it's going to grow overnight, I guess, when the NBA line is backed up. So that's kind of my hold up with him. He looks the part. I like a lot of things he does in the court, but without shooting, he kind of falls into that same mold of a lot of guys in that 25 to 45 cluster.
Yep. Okay, we wanted to talk about Josh Giddey today. You finally watched some NBL tape. Welcome to my world.
Not finally. I circled back. I watched two games of his early in the year, but now I'm back after the NCAA tournament stole all of our fun resources. Now I'm heading overseas.
What did you think of our sweet dear NBA Chalamet?
I was impressed. I know that was a lukewarm, I would guess, sign-off for me, but the full game I watched, he had 13 points, 13 assists, 6 rebounds. I really like his size as a facilitator at 6'8". He doesn't lack confidence in his ability at all. He believes in what he's doing. He's turned the corner better in pick and roll than he did earlier in the year when I watched. He can snake ball screens a little bit. My concern was he plays very upright, very stiff. He can have the ball picked by smaller guards, kind of like right after he crosses half court. His vision is so good that it bails him out of problems. Like, he can get the ball picked up, he'll pivot a little bit, then do some wild two-hand overhead pass for a wide-open guy under the hoop for a dunk or for a layup. Was blocked a little bit when he got into defenders' bodies in the lane. He makes those home run passes, also can force some stuff cross-court. The second game I watched, Justin Simon of, man, he was, where did Justin Simon finish? He was at Arizona, then St. John's, right?
I believe.
Yeah, St. John's. He got in him a little bit, rotated a block and shot some. Giddey's able to hit some threes, open threes with his feet set. It's not a great shot. He's averaging right now, shooting 33% from three, 42% from the field. Does average close to three turnovers a game, like I said, but 6.9 assists. He, I believe, is going to benefit now from sort of being this last man standing with the NCAA tournament being over and him playing well for his team at still 18 years old.
Yeah, I quite like Josh to the point where... So where would you put him on a like draft board at this point?
I got to watch more. I think it's a cheap way out to after watching two games and 100 offensive possession clips. But I'd say I'm comfortable middle first-ish. I wasn't sold. He's creeped up a couple places to like top 10. Like I just didn't see that.
Yeah, I don't see him as a top 10 guy. I would feel comfortable somewhere like 11 to 16. So I would even say like, you know, top half of that middle third for me. The reason that I like him is it's harder to find guys that are 6'8" with that level of feel for the game and like ball handling ability than what you would think. Than you would think necessarily, Penny, right. But just
yeah,
like
not me specifically. Yeah.
Proverbial, like basketball world. I think that it's harder to find those guys than you would think. And finding guys with genuine, like extremely high feel for the game, because that's like one thing. His passing ability is fucking ridiculous.
It is.
For a guy that's that size. Like, he is an unbelievable passer. He sees everything that's there. Like, he's, I think, going to lead the NBL in assists per game. If it's either going to be him or, like, Scotty Machado. You know, Scotty, you know, frankly, is, like, a very high-level NBA caliber distributor. He just can't really do anything else at that level. So, Giddey... When I watch him, you know, I think that I can't remember if you mentioned it now or if you mentioned it when we were talking beforehand or both times. You mentioned the fact that he plays very upright.
Yes.
And that's something I see as well, and something I'm like a little bit worried about. Like, I worry about how he generates NBA level explosiveness with that level of upright play, because he's just like not a lightning quick athlete. Like, learning to play with bend and like learning to play with some flexibility, I think could actually like unlock a little bit more burst out of his first step. Like, you kind of noted it as something that you see as like a negative. I almost see it as a growth area, like a real potential place where he gets a lot better. If he starts to get that like NBA level, like first, not even like NBA level first step, but if he can like improve that first step by like 20%, he's going to be really tough, I think. Because on top of that, like, where are you at on the shot? Because over the last little while, he started to shoot it a little bit more in a way that makes me think that, like, at some point, he's probably going to shoot threes at the NBA level. I know he's shooting 68 for the free throw line, 33 from three. But, like, everything I've heard about this kid is just, like, crazy, super high-level worker. Not going to have any issues, you know, at least getting to the point where he's like a catch and shoot guy. Where are you at on the jumper?
It does definitely, in the progression from earlier in the year to where we are right now, it's less of, it was before sort of a step in set shot, which is a weird thing to say, but it was very mechanical, kind of telegraphed he was going into it. It's more fluid now. It's a quicker release. And when it comes off his hand, he thinks it's going in almost every play. He kind of like raises his hand to the side thinking it would. And he hit like a big three late in the game and made some, some hand signal, and the announcers went bananas because I guess they wanted it to go in too. So it's improving.
The NBL announcers like want NBA Chalamet to be a thing. Like they want Giddey.
Thing, but yeah.
Yeah, they want Giddey to be like fucking amazing. And I love it. Like I love those guys. Like Liam Santa Maria, Homicide, like those guys are really fun announcers and they're really great. And you can just tell, like, when you watch these games, like
it's like he scored a goal in a soccer game. Like, get out. Yeah. Like, all right, fine, it's a three, but okay, it's a 1-0 goal. That's good too. We're way off track. All right. The driving stuff, yes, because he's going to need a quicker first step because he does hesitate a little bit. Guys do rotate to block his shot, and he's not powering up. He is dunking a little bit more on like some backdoor stuff, and if a weak side defender is slow to kind of make that jump across the lane, but he's not going to wow you with the athleticism. I have similar concerns with Cade Cunningham playing upright, and I'm not really worried about him figuring out the NBA, so maybe I should give Giddey a little bit of the benefit of the doubt there. It's the athleticism, not always going to be his strongest suit, which he makes up for it with the vision. But then defensively, is he going to be able to guard ones down the other end?
So here's the thing. Like, I don't really see him as a point, I guess, because he has the positional size of a three. Like, you're going to be able to slide him around with real lineup versatility in a way that makes him like very scalable, I think, to a lot of different potential lineup combinations. Like, you could play him next to Lou Williams and get like secondary ball handling pretty easily. You could play him like in the role that Utah plays Joe Ingles in next to a Donovan Mitchell as like a scorer and take some of that like playmaking load off of Donovan Mitchell, right?
Right. Some of that kind of like Tyrese Halliburton-ish role.
Right. Now, the key to this is, okay, he needs to shoot to be able to play that role.
Exactly. Yes.
I think he's going to shoot. Like, what I keep coming back to is, if you think he's going to shoot, which I do, he probably needs to be a lottery pick at the end of the day. Like, he just kind of does, because he's 6'8". He's an elite level passer. You're projecting the shot coming through. So it's kind of like a tailor-made secondary playmaker role at the NBA level. And then on top of it, like, the background and everything that I've been told is, like, pretty phenomenal. Like, super high-level kid, very professional, like, ready to get to work, kind of everything that comes with that. You know what I mean?
Right. But it's we keep coming back to it. There's some level of blind faith, and that's what we're saying about Bagley with a shortened season because of injury. Same with Josh Christopher, and he had a smaller sample size, and maybe Io gets, I don't know, I guess examined too close because he had so many games. It's where does a team willing to bet on one of those guys, whether it's winning, whether it's upside, whether it's a jumper, that they're going to take a risk in the late mid to late first round. You kind of put me on the hot seat last week just as a quick rapid fire. Would you take Giddy over Trey Mann, Jared Butler, Sharif Cooper?
So let's take those one by one. Trey Mann, I think, is probably the closest for me. I think I would take Giddy because I think he's going to have an easier time defensively than Trey Mann is. Sharif Cooper, again, like, defense, you know, just gonna have, he's way more scalable to winning situations than Sharif Cooper is, barring Sharif Cooper becoming a good shooter. And I'm more worried about Sharif's jumper because Sharif's jumper, it feels harder coming out of his hand, don't you think?
Yeah, for sure.
And then, I'm sorry, who was the third guy you mentioned?
Jared Butler, who seems to win a national championship, but also trending upwards on boards a little bit when people start saying, "Hey, he's pretty consistent." And those last games, he kind of put it together and was okay playing off the ball or on the ball.
Yeah, I'm going to pass on Jared Butler. I'm not sure what to do with him yet.
I don't even know really. Kind of, I was just looking at that point guard combo guard-ish type area there. Moody's more of a pure shooting guard, I would say, right?
So, like, to me, it's like, would I rather have Giddy or Chris Duarte? Because, like, I think that they're...
pulling at the heartstrings. Okay.
Different players, like, different skill sets. Duarte is, like, shooter in defense. Giddy is more playmaking, you know, passing, and size, even, than, like, Duarte.
And 6 years younger, yeah.
genuinely,
it's five, right? It's
he's at least five years younger, yeah.
Yeah.
I think I would take Giddy over Duarte because of that five-year age difference. But again, I think it would be situational too, like, depending on, like, okay, am I a team that can compete for a title, like, next year? Then I might take Duarte. But Giddy's upside's, like, considerably higher. Here's, like, another one. Like, I think I would take Giddy over Corey Kispert at this point too.
Oh, man. I just love the turn you've taken. Yeah. I'm not mad.
Okay,
at
here's
it.
Here's just... one, like, secondary non-primary playmaker, would you take Giddy or James Bouknight?
God, that's tough. That is tough. Because you're putting me in a corner. If I have, hypothetically, if I had a big board and James Bouknight was 13 and Giddy was 17, if I tell you one and not the other, then I got to change it. Am I allowed to pass until I watch more film? I think I'm
no,
I think
it's
I have
totally
that.
Fine.
I think, like, I have that lifeline left.
Yeah, none of these evaluations are set in stone. Like, we're still trying to, like, figure out, like, where we are on all these guys, like, in large part. You know, we have really high level evaluations on them now, but, like, you know, this is the time of year where we really go back and, like, dive into tape. Like, I'm starting my draft guide next week, like, getting to work on it 2.5 months ahead of time. So I have to write, like, 100 pages in 2.5 months, and my brain just, like, broke thinking about it. But
I was going to say, you put the pressure on yourself. I don't think editors, like, we need 100 pages.
Right.
It's very thorough. It's very good. I appreciate it. But you're hard on yourself with that.
Yeah. So, like, part of the process is, like, I run back and, like, really dive into tape on, like, a ton of guys when I do that. So, like, it's not that these things are set in stone, but, like, also, if I'm thinking about, like, how does Josh Giddey versus Jaden Springer work? I kind of think that if Giddey shoots it, it's a more scalable skill set.
Yes, I'd be Giddey there.
So, yeah, I mean, it's tricky. It's a tricky deal. But, like, I think I am at the point where I would pretty comfortably have Giddey, like, late lottery right now.
That's based on your comps. It sounds that range.
Yeah. Okay. So we're now at 63 minutes into this podcast, something like that, since we've been recording. The last three things we wanted to do, we're going to debut a new yes. segment, but before we do yeah. that, We're gonna do Penny recruiting stories. So give me a good Matt Penny recruiting story.
Oh, it's labeled recruiting stories. I feel like I've never told a recruiting story because I don't have many that are
yeah. PG event management. Rated, I guess. I feel like recruiting event management
college. Like, yeah. Because UMass won the national championship for hockey, I'm just going to tell a quick UMass basketball story. So my fifth year at UMass, because I walked on my junior year, played my senior year, then first year of graduate school, we had a great run that season, ended in the NIT finals versus Ohio State. Head coach was Travis Ford. He was a hot name at the time in coaching circles. So around the time of the team banquet after the season, there's more rumbling started to pop up. He was on the move. At one time it was Providence, another time LSU. Providence seemed to get a little traction, and then he decided he's going to stay at UMass. Great. Things escalated quickly shortly thereafter, and he's offered the head coaching job at Oklahoma State. Big budget, better league. There's really no hard feelings for anyone. We get it. And the nature of this business we're now in, people are thirsty for information. And I remember our sports information director said a certain media person called him 100 times in a day looking for updates. And this is even in like a pre-Twitter world. So it's like you can get this and write an article and post it online. Anyway. I'm not like sub tweeting anyone or sub whatever. I'm not taking shots. I don't even know who the person was. But anyway, the whole community knows coming. So that day, there's maybe a half dozen localish media people waiting outside the Mullen Center, which is our arena where we play, waiting for Coach Ford to come and make an announcement. And at this time, like I said, I'm a fifth year senior. My classes are at night. My eligibility is over. Life is really good for me at this point. I don't have many, if any, stresses. Some of my teammates are waiting to get intel and updates, but the day that Coach Ford is supposed to announce he's leaving, I get a text from someone in the athletic department saying he doesn't want to announce anything formal at the arena. And that's fine by me, and don't really know how this affects my life, but it's a sunny spring day. We're barbecuing outside, taking advantage of the last days of a college spring. And then the next text is, he's heading over to make a team announcement at your apartment. So we go full scramble mode, clean up fairly quickly. We're all in like bad jerseys and brightly colored mesh shorts. And he walks in and announces the program that he's leaving in my living room. So I have that fun fact that the news came per my puffed village apartment, and the media kind of like trickled over after, like, are they in your apartment right now? Is he saying he's leaving? I'm like, I don't know, man. You gotta talk to him.
Wait, like, were you living with other players? Cause I know who one of your roommates was, but like, were you living with other players too?
Yeah. So all the, I probably should have told that a little bit better there. We were all in this cluster of apartments that were like a first floor level. So we all lived in this like little horseshoe of four or five apartments together.
Right.
He didn't go into like some random guy's place. Like, hey, you're Craig, right? I just got to tell these guys something real quick.
Hey, Penny, we're having the team come over to your living room.
I got a burger, some dogs, a couple sodas. Like, yeah, go ahead, coach.
Do your shit. Okay, that's a good one. Did you at least like get the place presentable? Did the media come quickly, up and then quickly. Just like roast you?
They were there like the parking lot across the way, and they saw people coming outside, and they're like, yeah, we're gonna give you a few minutes here.
Okay. So this previous weekend we're gonna do a new segment. So now the new segment is called Sam Explores Australia.
This is too good.
So this weekend, I finally was able to get out of the house because the NCAA tournament is over, and we went to a wedding with one of like Laura's longtime like high school friends. And at the wedding, it's a very interesting experience because like typically when you've gone to a wedding before, Penny, you probably know the words to like most of the songs that come on like from the DJ. Right. Unless it's like a live band or something. And like if the live band's playing, that's like a totally different ball game. But if it's a DJ, like, you know, they're going to play like the same songs almost at every wedding. Right.
Yeah, you would hope so. My friends have a deep love for All For You by Sister Hazel. That's kind of like our trademark. But yeah, for the most part, it's the same songs.
So like All For You would have been well in my wheelhouse.
Right.
So we go to this wedding and like my wife and I are like dancing and everything, and this song comes on, and I'm just like, what the fuck is this? And every single person starts like blaring this song at the top of their lungs. And I'm just like, what the fuck is happening right now? This is not like a real thing. And it reminded me of a time I went to a bar in Los Angeles. I met up with good friend of the program, Mark Titus, and while we were there, I happened to just like see an agent that I know. And, you know, we were all kind of talking, Titus leaves and I'm like getting ready to leave. And it's probably 1 o'clock in the morning and Mr. Brightside comes on in this bar.
Oh, yeah, baby. That's College Town 101. Place explodes. Yeah.
But like, it wasn't College Town. It was like Beverly, like Boulevard in Los Angeles, like super
pretending
fucking,
they're in college. Yeah.
Like West Hollywood shit. And everyone in the bar starts screaming Mr. Brightside. It was like that, where everyone at this wedding of, you know, probably 80 people were there, 100 people were there, are screaming this song. And it's a very strange experience when you're in a, like, you're at a wedding and you don't know any word to any song that literally every single person at the wedding knows. Like, you feel super, it's, I had like the look on my face. I had to look like the biggest like fucking moron. Just like, what in the world is happening right now?
And do you open up like an app? Do you hold up your phone like a Shazam, or what was the app that?
So yeah, Shazam is the app. So
yeah.
Didn't do that, okay. But I get told that it's Jimmy Barnes is the guy and is the song singer. So I know who Jimmy Barnes is. For people who like don't know, Jimmy Barnes is the guy, if you've seen the meme of like the country singer in the sky like screaming, and I think that like the meme is like the big enough meme, like that's Jimmy Barnes. So I had to explain to everyone at the wedding, oh, I know who that guy is, he's a meme. And everyone's like, oh my god, he's like Australian music royalty. And I was like, oh, whoops. No, he's not a meme.
Yeah, no, big fan. Yeah.
Big fan. Yeah. So, yeah, was at a wedding in the middle of like wine country, Australia, learned Jimmy Barnes music this weekend, and was at a wedding where literally every single person knew the words to like three or four songs. And
oh man, that's
yeah, had no idea what was happening.
Did you go up to the DJ at any point and be like, hey man, can you play Mr. Brightside?
Hey man, can we get International Players Anthem or some shit?
Like, you know, oh, that's too good. Yeah, UGK. Yeah, oh, we were smart for our wedding. We actually hired the DJ from our favorite bar in college. So that's how you rig the system.
That's a smart move. That's a really good move.
Yeah, we closed our eyes. It felt like we were back at UMass despite not being there. Had enough friends that it felt like it was UMass, though.
Oh man, that's like next wedding level. That's like advice that people like listening to this podcast should take. That's a really good one.
Yeah, he was a friend of a friend, and he always helped us get into crowded bars when we weren't supposed to get into. So yeah, we that helped. That was good. That was a good party starter.
Oh my god, have I ever told the story of like the fake ID that I had in college?
I don't think you have. No.
So I randomly got this fake ID, and the ID and it's connected to college basketball. So it was Nolan Smith was the name on the ID.
You are not and, Nolan Smith, sir.
Yeah. I'm like somewhere between like 5'9", 5'10". The ID said like 6'3", and it worked probably like, you know, 8 or 10 times. And then I roll up to this bar. It's called Twos at Ohio State. And I don't think it's there anymore. I think it might have gotten, like, I think that block kind of got bought out. And I hand the guy the ID. Or no, it was a woman. I hand the woman the ID. And she goes, this is not you. And I'm just like, no, it's definitely me. I'm Nolan. And she goes, no, this is not you. He works here. And I was like,
that's really good.
Well, good call. Can I have the ID back? And she was like, yeah, sure, whatever. So
like, tell Nolan I said what up. Yeah.
I was like, well,
I was just dropping it off, actually. Yeah, it's what a coincidence.
So yeah. Oh wow. That's a great idea, the wedding.
Do it.
Doing
hire a college DJ. Yeah.
College bar DJ. That's a fucking phenomenal, like, that is like wedding advice 101, Penny. That's really good.
It's a good life hack. Yeah. I'm telling you about how to feed 2-year-olds, keep them happy during truck shows, and how to blast your wedding.
Oh man, this is a great podcast right now. Okay, final thing we always finish on is movies. You explained something that you watched to me earlier, and I've seen it come up on Netflix, and I'm excited to watch it. Let me know what you think. Let me know what it is.
So I believe the name of the documentary is called "This Is a Robbery," and it's about the Isabella Stewart Gardner Art Museum heist in Boston, about 10 minutes from me, which was like the biggest art heist actually in like the history of the world, I want to say. There was like $500 million worth of, I think that's the number, of art stolen overnight. There was disguises involved and the mafia using for bartering stuff for lighter sentences. And it's a wild ride for 4 episodes, but felt very authentic with the characters and where the art was allegedly held up and the people involved, the accents. I felt very at home with the criminals of Boston being described.
That's a dream. That's a good one right there. I'm going to have to watch that one. Laura and I are going on vacation this weekend. Maybe that's what we'll watch. Okay.
So what do you got? What do you got? Yeah, I know you got something. You got a few.
I've watched quite a bit, actually. So now that the season's over, I watched... Laura and her family are big fans of trying to find like every weird, random like genre thriller or like horror movie that we can find. So last night we watched a movie called The Boat, which was not great, I didn't think. Suspenseful, well-made, just like never really got there. Yesterday I also watched Better Luck Tomorrow, which is an old movie from 2002. It's Justin Lin, the guy who's directed 4 of the 8 Fast and Furious movies and now will be directing the last 2. He made this movie for $250,000. It was funded by MC Hammer randomly.
Like that.
And it's one of the first movies to feature like all Asian characters, like Asian American characters, within a like Hollywood / independent, like it was eventually released like wide to 400 theaters. One of my favorite movies I've seen in a long time. It's like crime movie, coming of age movie, like really, really good. So I would suggest that. I watched Come True, which is on, I think it's Esquire's list of the top 15 releases so far in 2021. Didn't totally get there for me. And then over the weekend, I watched Panic Room, which, you know, great movie. I'm sure you've seen
Panic Room. Jodie Foster?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Way back. I was like, man, they redid that or just watching the original?
No, I've been watching a lot of older movies, weirdly, the last few days. And then I watched Heart 8, which is Paul Thomas Anderson's first movie. From 1996 and was just, I mean, fucking in Las Vegas and Reno, like in casinos. So of course it was my shit.
you always make me feel like an idiot during this part. Like you watch a thing, I'm like, yeah, the guys in Boston robbed the art museum. You're like, yeah, I watched 8 things. I circle back to Panic Room. Like, man,
you
cover the wide range.
The thing that you watch though is like 4 parts, isn't it?
Yeah, it was four like 1 hour parts. Some were like 45 minutes, but yeah.
Yeah, so like I watched like 4 movies in the time that you watch 4 parts. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's fair.
So yeah no, like I'm excited to watch that. I'm excited to watch Beartown, I think is one. Was it you also that was telling me about like the Varsity Blues scandal thing on Netflix?
Yeah, so I watched that on Netflix, yeah. And I started to watch Tell Me Your Secrets on Amazon, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've gotten advice to watch the Varsity Blues thing, that it was pretty interesting. Yeah, and then I'm also supposed to watch the QAnon thing. One of our media friends told me to watch the Into the Storm QAnon deal.
Yeah, you got to be in the right frame of mind and tinfoil hat for that. I'll get there. I got to watch more NBL tape before I get to that place in my brain.
Penny, tell the people where they can find your work.
I am on Twitter, @Matt_Penny. Like I never left. You always say I'm in the building, but I'm always here. I'm always within arm's length.
Love it. Rate, review, subscribe, do everything you can to support the show. We'll be back later next week with some more. Sometime in the middle of that, I'm going to get back into the NBA and like really catch up on NBA tape. I might have a special guest come on later this week and explain what has happened in the last 3 weeks of the NBA during the college basketball season, because that'll be a good one to teach me what's going on, because I need to figure out what's going on. So please remember to follow through with all of the ways you can support the show. But until next time, we'll talk soon. Bye.